Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. On the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, with high-speed rail's Central Valley stretch now nearly $3 billion over budget, the legislature is pursuing its own audit of the rail authority. We talk with Assemblyman Jim Patterson, the driving force behind the audit, on what he thinks the authority should do as a plan B. We'll also take a look at air quality apps for your smartphone. There are a lot out there, but do they really work? We'll give you our review of their performance. And a Sanger native getting national attention for his innovative take on mariachi. All that coming up a little later on. We begin, though, with an update. Last week, we brought you an investigative story about a secretive building in downtown Fresno that's being used to process individuals coming into custody of immigration enforcement officials. There's no sign on the building, no idea outwardly to the public of what goes on there. We published that story on our program last week, and we received a lot of feedback on that story and also some new information. Our reporter, Carrie Klein, joins us now. Carrie, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
So first of all, give us a refresher course for people who haven't heard that story, didn't see it on our website at kvpr.org. What's this ICE building in downtown Fresno all about?
Yeah, so it's exactly what you said. It was a sort of mysterious building downtown Fresno on L Street near Bitwise and the Hilton DoubleTree Hotel, completely unmarked, highly secured. And we had heard from immigration attorneys that this is where Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, where it processes individuals it believes are in the country illegally. And these immigration advocates and attorneys were really concerned, not because this is illegal, they're not alleging that, but just because processing people in this way, in this building that is completely under the radar and kind of difficult to find the address of otherwise, you know, without much in the way of public relations or communication, you know, that could put civil liberties and due process at risk for these detainees.
And America's not known for having secret jails. Even our police stations and jail facilities are well marked for the most part.
That's right.
So that story aired last week and we got a lot of response. We also got, finally, a response from ICE. And I know that wasn't the first time we had asked for one.
That's correct. We had reached out to a number of different people before the story came out, had heard nothing, not even turning down our interview requests. But so they did. After reading our story, a spokesman from San Francisco reached out. That was really important. And he was able to confirm a number of things in the story that we had suspected or that we had written about. He also filled in a few gaps that we hadn't had before. He also confirmed that after publishing the story, the office actually put up a sign. You know, it's a little printed sign. It's not anything big, but it's on the door. And it says Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the hours of the building. So that's a big improvement compared to what it was before.
So what did ICE tell us about this facility?
Well, so he confirmed that, yes, indeed, this is an ICE office. We did know that already. But he said this is specifically a sub-field office serving a field office in San Francisco. He asserted that it is not a detention facility, though it does have a quote, secure space for interviewing and briefly holding individuals, unquote, and they can be held for up to 12 hours in this facility.
So in their view, it's not a detention facility, but one that can detain people.
Or
where people detained at.
Yes, that's correct. For up to 12 hours, yeah. Certainly not a pleasant experience for anyone who would be in that situation. And we had said in our story that this is possibly a facility called the Fresno Hold Room, which we had come across through data from ICE. And that room was responsible for processing over 1,000 detainees in the year 2015. He confirmed, yes, this is the Fresno Hold Room, which was really important because we didn't have an address for that specific facility. He also confirmed the presence of a Bakersfield hold room, which we also thought we knew about. And he also confirmed that there are 9 total subfield offices like these that serve the San Francisco field office. And all these facilities, there's just 9 facilities in Northern California and some Pacific Islands, though he wouldn't name how many more of these subfield offices and holding rooms there are around the country.
Now, there's a treasure trove of data about these facilities archived on the ICE website about who they process. What do we know now about that?
Yeah, so it is indeed a treasure trove. I mean, it is an enormous data set. It's in their FOIA library, FOIA being the Freedom of Information Act. And it has information on over 300,000 detainees in ICE custody in the year 2015. And so we were able to extract how many of those actually had been processed here in the Fresno holdroom and in the Bakersfield holdroom. And this is only from 2015. We do not have data more recent than that. And of course, signs are pointing to enforcement activity being on the rise. Also point to perhaps people are being picked up for much lesser crimes than they used to be, but we have not been able to confirm that. But in this 11-month period in 2015, about 1,100 detainees were processed in this Fresno hold room. There are no names or identifying information, just descriptors. These 1,100 detainees were overwhelmingly Hispanic, mostly from Mexico, some from El Salvador and Guatemala, also many representatives from Laos and Vietnam. They're overwhelmingly male, majority in their 20s to 40s. And the most serious crimes of all of these detainees really ran the gamut, but most were what we'd call high level. I mean, they're murders, violent crimes, domestic abuse, sex offense, drug offenses, DUIs, things like that. I also found people's transfer histories to be really interesting. It lists for each detainee how many detention facilities they had been to in just the year 2015. The most common number was three. So after the Fresno holdroom, they had been to two more after that. But there was one detainee processed here who passed through more than 48 facilities after that, just in this one year. He was, you know, a major outlier, though. And lastly, about three quarters of those processed here that year ended up leaving the country, mostly deported or self-deported. And then otherwise they could have been bonded out, handed over to U.S. Marshals or other law enforcement agencies, or they were allowed to live normal lives out in the community but had to check into ICE regularly.
So there's also, as you said, a subfield office and hold room in Bakersfield. What do we know about that facility? And that's separate from the official detention facility that ICE operates in Kern County and again, has been very public about its existence. This is another one of these that is in this report. What do we know about the hold room in Bakersfield?
Yeah, that's right. The Mesa Verde detention facility is much, much, much larger. It's well known and many, many detainees there at a time for long term. These are short term facilities, these hold rooms. This one is actually much bigger than the one in Fresno. So while there are about 1,100 people processed in Fresno in 2015, the number was over 2,600 in Bakersfield. So more than twice as many people processed here. And otherwise, the demographics were very similar. There were overwhelmingly Mexican male, and almost all of them ended up being deported.
And I understand we also heard from a lot of people who listened to that story and had their own input on it. Mm-hmm. One of them actually with a personal experience about this.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a person who reached out to us and thanked us for the story. He said that he had actually been held in this facility for a number of hours. He said it was by mistake and that he was cleared by his attorney. And he says that every time he drives by or walks by, he wondered if other people knew what was in here.
Well, great job on bringing this story to light. And now people know, in fact, people walking by will know what goes on at that facility.
Yes, indeed.
Again, on L Street in downtown Fresno, that building that is operated by ICE. That story brought to you here on Valley Public Radio last week. Following up with it today, our own Carrie Klein. Carrie, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For the first time since 2012, the state legislature is giving the California High-Speed Rail Authority a thorough audit. The news comes just weeks after cost estimates from the Rail Authority's top consultant show the Central Valley portion of the line is billions of dollars over budget. The request for the audit is a move that comes at the request of our next guest, Fresno Assemblymember Jim Patterson, who joins us now. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What are you looking for in the audit? What do you hope to find?
Well, first of all, we have found through some reporting, through admissions by the authority, several disturbing trends. One, it's 7 or 8 years overdue. We have several billions of dollars in cost overruns. We had executives departing and very slow to replace those individuals. And then we discovered that the authority has had to move money from, it's called an emergency transfer, from the account that pays for the relocation of the utility wires and towers, et cetera, had to move about $35 million over to the construction budgets in order to keep the hard hats on the job. All of those are significant indicators of a project that is increasingly in trouble, and that those areas are going to be the fundamental focus of the audit.
Do you think the legislature has been remiss in not doing one of these audits since 2012?
Well, I think we've missed opportunities to do what I think our constituents elect us to do. Whether you think that high-speed rail is a good idea or not, or you're somewhere in the middle, the fact of the matter is there's so much at stake here, and to have the kinds of problems emerging. Yes, I do think that the legislature missed its fundamental oversight responsibility. But I think the unanimous vote of the Joint Committee does demonstrate that there are substantial concerns from both sides of the aisle and from those who think high-speed rail is a good idea or a bad idea or somewhere in the middle. It's time to get way past the politics. It's time to find out what in the world is going on. And then I think the next decision is going to be a significant one, which is what next? It appears to me that Plan A is failing, that the latest revelation of cost overruns seemed to indicate that completing the project from just outside Bakersfield to Silicon Valley does not have adequate money now to complete the route. So we're looking at what? So what is Plan B? I think the opportunity to discover what Plan B might look like will come as the audit delves into some of the local issues. But also remember, in a couple of months, we are going to see the next business plan, and that business plan will be authored and overseen by Brian Kelly and some new people recently appointed to the authority. I think 2018 is going to be a very significant year, either makes or breaks the project, because of the weight of the issues that the authority is facing.
You mentioned Brian Kelly, the new CEO of the Rail Authority, and the difficulty, or at least the long time, that job was vacant. Are you in any way encouraged with his expertise coming into that top job there, coming from the California Transportation Agency?
I really don't know. I hope what we get is clear-headedness and honesty. Remember, it was over a year ago that the Los Angeles Times reported on the Federal Rail Administration's warning to high-speed rail. And I can recall, in front of hearings in which I was a participant, over a year ago, the Rail Authority sat there and said this was excessive, this was exaggeration, and this isn't going to happen. And I questioned it at the time. And here we are over a year later that, almost to the dollar, the cost overrun warning that the Federal Rail Authority issued to the High Speed Rail Authority said it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 or $11 billion. So the initial operating segment, since I've been in the legislature, has gone from $6 billion, then it went to $8 billion, now it's $11 billion. And so what I'm hoping for is honesty. Telling the Californians and the legislature the truth of the project. And quite frankly, I think that the project is at a place where Brian Kelly and the authority may have very, very limited options. So I think what is the next saga in the story is going to be what this new business plan has to say about the initial operating segment and whether or not it can be completed.
So let's move on to that. Do you see this audit in going into that level of depth on the committee's own part at looking at how to maybe wind this down or take a different approach? Or are you going to let the Rail Authority lead that dance, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think first things first. The audit is going to take a look at why it's so delayed, why it's so costly. Does the Rail Authority actually have the wherewithal and the expertise to actually manage a project that is apparently this much out of control? Secondly, I intend to look very clearly at the business plan. This business plan will come before me again in the same committee. I sit on the budget subcommittee that is going to review, analyze, and essentially have public open hearings about what this business plan is going to look like. That will give me an opportunity, and others who are as concerned, the opportunity to delve into that business plan and ask some serious and deep and leading questions about what is this actually going to be. The interesting thing, though, you hear sort of scuttlebutt or behind the scenes from very well-placed sources in the authority that they may very well have to devise a plan B that may or may not go between south of Bakersfield and into Silicon Valley. There has also been some quiet discussions off the record about perhaps if it can't be completed, then it may be bequeathed to Amtrak and be substantially expensive, but improvements to Amtrak nonetheless. So there is, I think, whether we see eye to eye on the high-speed rail, is it a project that actually can be reasonably brought in and actually completed, or is it in fact a failing project? We're all past all of that now, because I think no matter where you are on the spectrum of support or opposition or somewhere in the middle, finding the truth and finding out what in the world do we know and what in the world are we going to do next, I think is in everybody's interest, no matter where they fall on the spectrum of support or opposition to high-speed rail.
Isn't that process, though, of going in a different direction complicated by the promises made to voters who approved the initial round of bond funding back in 2008, that we're going to have this train that goes from here to there in a certain
yes.
amount of time? And then also in the federal funding that came through in the Obama administration, there were various benchmarks and things that had to be met, independent utility, those sorts of things. Does it make it more difficult than just pulling the plug on something like this?
Well, look, there's such a thing as economic gravity. You can have wishful thinking and you can make all of the plans that you want to, but if you run out of money, you hit economic gravity, the reality. I mean, you can jump off the top of the Empire State Building and think you're flying until you hit ground zero. Economic reality is just like gravity. There is a finite amount of money, and the more you explode the price tag and delay it, the more money you need to keep it on track. There does come a point at which you have to ask the question, what do we do next if we run out of money? I think that's the next phase in all of this. And short billions of new money from the private sector and billions of new money from the federal government, I just don't see how it gets completed. And I just think that forcibly requires leaders in the state of California to take a look at what Plan B looks like.
Certainly, there's a lot of blame and finger-pointing going around with regards to the project. Don't, to some degree, rail opponents take at least some of the credit for the rising costs of this project, given the lawsuits that have been one of the sources for delays for moving the project along?
I think that's sort of an excuse by the High Speed Rail Authority. If you think that the litigation and the lawsuits and the negative response to blowing through neighborhoods and blowing through mountains and earthquake faults and all that, wait till you get into Los Angeles or up into the Bay Area. They have a huge challenge in front of them to get into San Jose through the passes that they have decided to go through. So I think what we've learned is that this project will have substantial opponents litigating all along the right of way. And I think it is foolish to simply blame Central California people for exercising their privilege of litigation and their privilege of, you know, attempting to redress a grievance against the authority. They will have similar challenges, and I think those challenges are much, much greater when they get to the other ends of the system. They're going through the easiest part of this system now, and they're demonstrating that it is far more expensive and much more difficult than they had planned. And I think it's going to be even more so at the other ends.
And those lawsuits, of course, are not limited to those brought by Valley groups. Atherton residents and others are also among those groups. There's been also some talk looking back. Maybe it's sort of Monday morning quarterbacking. But do you think Caltrans maybe would have been an agency to run this better than an independent high-speed rail authority? Is that maybe one of the issues at fore here?
Well, it might be, but I honestly don't have any more confidence in Caltrans as I do in the High-Speed Rail Authority. This really started out as a political idea, and it was sold to voters as one thing, and we are now discovering that the one thing they said they could do, they simply cannot do. And instead of recognizing the error of really politicizing this from the beginning, we're now seeing it unwind by just the force of the economics at play. And so I think we've got to disabuse ourselves of the political purity of the High-Speed Rail Authority or Caltrans. This is like Jerry Brown's tunnels. This is Jerry Brown's high-speed rail. It has been politically driven at all cost and no matter what. And as I said before, sooner or later, economic gravity catches up with ideology and politics. Now we have got to decide what's going on, how do we get this sidetracked, and what do we do about Plan B? We owe it to everybody in the state of California to be clear on this. There is so much at stake that I think the only solution here is to disabuse ourselves one way or the other of the politics of this, analyze it with clear heads and clear eyes, and then come clear to the people of California that what was promised may not be able to be delivered. And then I think we've got to ask the people of California, what is your idea about Plan B? I think that's where this is heading.
We've been talking with Assemblymember Jim Patterson. The Fresno Republican has been among the High-Speed Rail Authority's staunchest critics. And the legislature's Joint Audit Committee is now moving forward on his request to conduct an audit of the Rail Authority after news the project is now almost $3 billion over budget on its Central Valley stretch. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Always enjoy it.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This winter has been especially bad for air pollution in the San Joaquin Valley. Of course, knowing about the air we breathe is important for our health, but how to stay informed? Broadcast news outlets like Valley Public Radio and other outlets share air quality information in their forecasts, but where do you go if you're not catching those updates? And what if you're on the go? Reporters Carrie Klein and Laura Tsutsui are here with us to take a look at mobile apps for air quality and put them to the test. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks.
Hi, Joe.
Laura, I want to start with you. Where do you go when looking for air quality information on your mobile device?
So I have an iPhone, and I started when we looked into this, I thought that maybe I would be able to find some air quality info in my built-in weather app. So I poked around there, figured out what the weather was like, but couldn't find anything about what the air was like. So I ended up just going to the San Joaquin Valley Air District. They have monitors throughout the valley, and ended up figuring out how to navigate their website to find out what the air is like right now, what they're forecasting it as for today, and you know, what the trends have been.
So the Valley Air District has its own mobile app in addition, though, to its website, at least if you're an iPhone user.
Yes, that's correct. So I ended up downloading their app as well, and it's pretty great because the website's kind of cluttered with a lot of different places to click, but the Valley Air app, once you download it, it's called Valley Air, and you set up sort of where you are, then you can see right off the bat readings for ozone and particulate matter, and then also a forecast for the day. One of the things that is great, though, is the forecast is color-coded. So I know it's green today, the air is good. And then later throughout the day, it will give a forecast for tomorrow as well.
So you're saying that the app the Air District has actually has two different data sets, both a forecast and an actual observation level. Is that something that you found in a lot of other apps?
Sometimes. I think the thing to keep in mind is those readings for ozone and particulate matter are updated hourly, and it has a timestamp on it. So I can see what it said at noon, what it said at 10 this morning. And then the forecast just is one number for the entire day. But some of the other apps we looked at, it was hard to determine in some cases exactly what all the numbers meant in other apps. But the Valley Air one seemed very explicit.
And I know that with mobile apps, sometimes the big thing is also notifications. How does that work with that app?
Yeah, so you can set it to send you notifications. You have to turn them on, obviously. And so I actually got one in the middle of the day that just said, today the air is good. And then you can also set a notification to ask it to tell you when it hits a certain threshold. So if maybe you want to know when the air quality is unhealthy for sensitive groups or unhealthy, you can set it to do that. It's a little hard to get that turned on, though. Oftentimes when you download an app for the first time, it just says, do you want to turn on notifications? I clicked yes, and then went back through my settings and realized none of these notifications were actually turned on. I had to turn them on. And even now I'm, you know, still testing this app, trying to figure out, okay, when am I actually going to get a notification yet? So far the air's been good today, so I haven't gotten anything saying it's been unhealthy yet.
So that's the Valley Air District app. Right now it's only available though for iPhones. However, the Android user base is represented here by our own Carrie Klein.
That's
Carrie,
right.
You were out of luck when you were looking for the Valley Air app.
Yep, it is not available on Android yet. They do say that's coming soon. It could be as early as March. We'll see. So, yes, I was trying this out from the Android point of view, and I looked in my native weather app as well, and I actually had a lot more luck than Laura did. So the weather app on my Google Pixel actually has air quality information right there in kind of the main page. I don't need to click on anything separate and go anywhere else, which is really nice. It has the air quality index, which is kind of a composite measure of a couple of these different things. However, you can't click on it to get any more information other than that. So if I wanted to get specific PM levels or specific ozone levels, I couldn't get that. That's a little disappointing, but for, you know, a 10-second what's my air quality, it's pretty good. You could stop right there, or you could continue on and look at some other apps in the App Store.
I want to take a step back now here for our listeners who might be listening to us and maybe want a refresher course on a lot of the terminology that we're using here today. We've got PM, AQI, ozone, and then you have other terminology like the Air District uses, like the RAN network or the roar level. What's going on here with all this alphabet soup?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the two most problematic pollutants here in this area are particulate matter, PM, and ozone. They're problematic in different times of the year. PM is more of a wintertime issue. Ozone more in the summertime. AQI is called the air quality index, and it is a it's kind of a quick and dirty measure of air quality based on whatever pollutant is worse. It's a number scale from about 0 to 500, and the higher the number is, the worse the air quality is. And what's nice about AQI is it also has a color coded scale, so that if numbers are meaningless to you. You don't need to memorize what the scale is, but you know, if air quality is good, it's green, or if it's bad, it's purple or maroon. So that's a really nice way to really visually quickly understand what the AQI is. And then of course, RAN is the real-time air advisory network that we have here at our San Joaquin Valley Air District. And that's the website that they run as this network.
And they use their own level of hourly readings, which they call ROAR, which is similar to AQI, but slightly different,
least
in the way it measures, AQI being a 24-hour average. So you were out of luck when it came to the Valley Air app right now on Android, but the EPA has its own app, and that's cross-platform. Carrie, tell me about that.
Yeah, EPA app is cross-platform. It's called AirNow. AirNow is also the name of a website that they have. Laura and I kind of agreed this app was a little bit disappointing. It does have the basic air quality information you want. It has AQI. It's accurate. The EPA is definitely an accurate source of information. It breaks that data out into PM and ozone levels, so it's nice. However, it's really utilitarian. It's really not that. It doesn't have very many features, and that's kind of disappointing because on the AirNow website itself, it has this national map where you can see air quality across the country and you can interact with it and click on it and everything. You just don't get that in this app.
Yeah, absolutely. It's super simple. So if you want something bare bones, I guess that could work for you. But if you're maybe into more of the details, it's pretty lackluster.
That's right.
Yeah, I was looking at the app. It looked like something that one might have seen on the web back in the mid-90s when the World Wide Web was a new thing.
Uh-huh.
So not the most visually appealing, but it does, I presume, have reliable data.
It does.
So Laura, when it comes to other apps that aren't from official government sources, well, what are some of the ones that you've downloaded and had a chance to evaluate?
Yeah, one of the ones that I was looking at that's actually cross-platform, but right now I have it on my iPhone, is called Air Matters, and it shows the air quality. It does a little bit of weather as well, but as far as Carrie and I could tell, it's pulling its data from these regulatory air monitors, so that makes us think that the data is reliable. It doesn't say if the readings right off the bat are averages from, you know, the previous 24 hours or current, so when I'm looking at it, I'm not sure what it's saying right now, but it does show a forecast for today. The thing to keep in mind, though, is as I was comparing it against my Valley Air and my EPA readings, that forecast was a little off. It says today is moderate, but it's not, and today the Air District says it's good. One of the characteristics of this app is it takes pollen into consideration, and maybe it's just weighing pollen very highly because today there's like a high pollen count, and pollen wasn't actually something that we didn't notice in really any of the other apps to be a very prominent thing. But in this one in particular, that's actually, if you sort of click the reading, it's the first thing that comes up is pollen. And then you kind of scroll down, and then it does show, again, ozone and PM and some other pollutants. And it also is color-coded. So those are all green, except this pollen reading is yellow. And so for whatever reason, it's a little off. And I think that might be why.
And of course, pollen not factored into the EPA's definition of air quality, although
right.
It may be important to some people. Carrie, what about the Air Visual app, another free app that's available cross-platform?
Yeah, this is another free one. And we should say this one and Air Matters are some of the first two that come up when you do search within your app store. So it's good to know a little bit about these. So Air Visual, Laura and I think both agreed this one is pretty decent and pretty intuitive. It's nice to use. Right up front underneath a city name, you list your location underneath the city name. It has the AQI with the color, with a happy or sad face. I mean, it's really, and again, if you're looking for something in 5 or 10 seconds to understand air quality, this will give it to you. The data come out of the EPA. The issue, though, is that it's not entirely clear which data are actually a forecast and which are actual conditions. So that's a little bit of a red flag. It also provides a 7-day forecast, which just isn't out there. The Air District and the EPA are not forecasting air quality that far. So you're not really, you can't rely on that. Don't know where that data is coming from. But otherwise, it's a pretty good app.
So Laura, there's a lot of weather apps that are out there for smartphones. What about those? Do some of those have decent data for air quality?
Yeah. So while my iPhone native weather app was disappointing when it comes to air quality, I found one that did work. It was called Weather Underground. It's also a free app as well. And while its primary focus is telling you about weather details, once I kind of scrolled through that, there was a little section where it focused on the air quality and had an AQI index. It was color-coded and had this smiley face emoji that was green also, so I was reading, oh, the air quality is green. It takes its data from regulatory monitors and actually low-cost ones like the Purple Air one we have, so these Internet of Things monitors. You can actually connect your own personal one if you'd like, so we could connect the one we have at the station. And then this one also had a 7-day forecast, and as Carrie said with the previous one, you know, it's the other regulatory agencies don't do 7-day forecasts, so we really don't know if that's accurate.
And Carrie, I understand one other thought is you don't necessarily have to use an app to use it like an app on your smartphone.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, and a lot of these apps that we've mentioned have websites that go along with them. And sometimes the websites are better than the apps are, or they're more informative or easier to use. So if you really want to, keep using that, you can go to that website on your phone in your browser, and then you can add that page to your homepage so that you can just tap on it from your homepage. It's not an app. It won't give you notifications the way that an app would, but it's really easy to use that way.
Laura, any final thoughts?
Yeah, you want an app or a website that is informative. When it comes specifically to apps, the ones that I liked best that I felt had like the nicest user experience and had reliable information were actually the third-party ones, not necessarily the apps from regulatory agencies. They just looked nicer, and I could see myself opening it to see the info. But ultimately, you want to know if your data is good and where that data is coming from. So it's up to the user to decide what works best for them.
You can find some links and our quick reviews of air quality apps on our website at kvpr.org, part of our ongoing coverage of the air quality issue here in the Valley. Carrie Klein and Laura Tsutsui are reporters for Valley Edition. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Critics across the globe are starting to pay attention to the music of one young Valley artist, Omar Narre. The Sanger native was recently profiled on Public Radio International for his fresh take on mariachi traditions. He's taking traditional songs and reinventing them with hints of jazz, soul, and funk. It's a cultural fusion which will be on display at Bitwise in downtown Fresno on Saturday. From the Ground Truth Project, Kainat Khan brings us the story of how Narre is trying to redefine a genre for the 21st century.
Inside a cavernous building in downtown Fresno, Omar Narre is doing a sound check on his guitar. He's about to play at a gallery opening for one of his artist friends. Omar calls his music Nuevo Mariachi, New Mariachi.
We're in a search. That's where mariachi is right now. It's searching. It's searching for what's next. It's 120 years old, and it's got to be going someplace new.
Omar isn't wearing the mariachi suit, which is called a charro. He looks trendy in a button-down shirt and jeans and boots. He stands at the mic alone. No backup singers, no trumpets or fanfare. It isn't what I imagine when I imagine mariachi. Omar is trying to find a modern take on a Mexican tradition. But maybe modern isn't the right word. Maybe a better way to say it is that Omar is trying to find a Californian take on mariachi.
Because I'm not Mexican. I was not born in Mexico. I was born in Sanger, California. I was born to a Mexican-American mom and an Arabic father.
He reveres mariachi, its history and what it represents. But Omar was disillusioned by how mariachi had kind of stalled.
I saw many of the same songs get played in the same way by every mariachi band and every Mexican restaurant that has a mariachi. I think that we should be allowed to adapt and change. That's really what it's about for me.
To understand Omar's search and where he is going with Nuevo Mariachi, we have to learn about where he comes from.
Well, right now we're on the 180.
Omar drives me to Sanger, California, the small town about 20 minutes outside Fresno, where he grew up. This is the heart of California's Central Valley. It's where a quarter of the food Americans eat is grown. Flat stretches of fruit trees framed by mountains in the distance. The valley's existence is inextricably bound up with agriculture and the Mexican farm laborers who came here to work. Omar's grandfather was one of them.
So they came in to work the land over, and my grandfather came first. And my grandma was every tree, every plant she knew.
Not me. I wish that's a knowledge that I lost, which is a knowledge that I wish that I did. But I know what it's like to work in the fields. I've definitely been in the trees picking fruit, having a branch poke at your back. You know, this is the house.
We arrive at Omar's Mexican grandfather's ranch, where we meet Omar's Uncle Ruben, who now owns the house. Omar grew up hearing Mexican music, and his tío Ruben taught him his first mariachi songs.
He was very small, and then I had the guitar, and we're just playing some crazy little simple tunes, and he starts to sing, like, and I saw that in him immediately. I knew he had the voice to sing. So I was trying to surprise his mom, my sister, and then when we threw a party at the house, he goes ahead, okay, I'm like, go ahead and sing, and he starts singing it to the family, and that's where everything started.
Llego a mi casa vacía y tranco la puerta.
When Omar and his family discovered he had a talent, he went from singing at family gatherings to playing gigs as a child mariachi singer. He started traveling and performing multiple gigs on weekends around the state.
I do remember one time we were driving. I think that we had done a show in Parlier, and the sun was hitting the stage. I was roasting, and I was wearing leather pants. I got off the stage, we ran to the car because we had to go to some other type of gig. And I just remember that I was in the back seat and my mom was laughing at me, cracking up at me because I could not get the pants off to change into my other outfit, you know? That's what it was like though, changing in the car, pull over, there's a road stop, gotta change, put something else on so you look fresh, wipe your face down. Do you have your sound system? Yeah. Do you have the songs that you're gonna sing? Yeah, yeah, yeah. We got all the cables. Okay, next gig. Next gig. It was a grind.
At one of these gigs, when Omar was about 16 or 17, a producer for Sony Music approached him and his family about recording a demo tape and making Omar a Latin pop star. So Omar and his mom flew to Italy to record these new tracks with professional producers and songwriters. But it wasn't what they were expecting. Omar remembers seeing explicit photos on the walls, and his mom recalls being hit on. It wasn't the environment she wanted for him.
We wanted the best for him, and at that point, that wasn't the best for him.
Omar went to college pretty soon after returning from Italy. After he got his degree from Fresno State, he went back to being a working musician, but not a mariachi. He played in a salsa band, a reggaeton band.
At one point, I think I was playing in 12 bands.
He didn't come back to mariachi until years later, as Omar tells it, after a conversation with a friend from Mexico City, who told him,
Omar, para la juventud en México, el mariachi está muerto.
For the young people of Mexico City, mariachi is dead.
That punched me in my gut. It really hurt me. And I started to remember my youth. And I thought to myself, mariachi is this cultural identity. Yeah, I ran away from it. I get that. But to say that the music sucks, it really punched me in my gut. That was the seed.
Querida, la noche está tan fría. Toco tu alma.
Around the same time he had that conversation, Omar played a show for Eva Longoria's charity. That's right, the Mexican-American actress. At an after-party, the musicians passed around a guitar. When they asked Omar to play...
Don't ask me why, but I started singing mariachi songs.
Y volver, volver, volver.
Eva Longoria came out of her house and was just like listening. Doing gritos, eso, canta, you know, like 4 a.m. party. Afterwards, she came up to me and she says, that's what makes you special. Keep doing that.
Those two interactions inspired Omar to revisit the music of his childhood. Omar started trying to figure out if he could, as he often said, add a new branch to the old tree of mariachi.
Querida, yo te necesito aquí a mi lado, por favor, querida. Regresa con tu amor.
I haven't understood exactly what about Nuevo Mariachi is new. Omar recently did a cover of a famous mariachi song called Sabor a Mi. I asked him what he changed about the song that made it Nuevo Mariachi.
Sabor a Mi was written many years ago, and it's a classic bolero. It's been covered by everybody. Sabor a Mi. We've heard it a million times. First thing that I did is I fell back on my training and I looked at the melody notes. And I just started playing with chords because I wanted to take away this jolly feeling that I had, you know? And I changed the feeling.
Tanto tiempo disfrutamos de este amor, nuestras almas se acercaron, tanto así.
There, like, it feels like a different song.
Tanto tiempo disfrutamos de este amor, nuestras almas se acercaron, tanto así, que yo guardo tu sabor. Pero tú llevas también sabor a mí.
Si negaras, I want Sabor a Mi, this version, to become my symbol of what I plan to do with Nuevo Mariachi. We take something that's classic, we reinterpret it through this new lens, and out comes something completely different.
I ask Omar whether his grandfather would like Nuevo Mariachi.
I think that if my grandfather was alive, I think there's still enough mariachi in my mariachi that he would love it.
No soy nada, yo no tengo vanidad de mi vida, doy lo bueno, soy tan pobre que otra cosa puedo dar. Pasarán más de mil años, muchos más. Yo no sé si tenga amor la eternidad, pero allá tal como aquí, en la boca llevarás sabor a mí.
Find a longer version of Omar's story on the Ground Truth podcast website. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We continue our program now with a look at a series of events coming up this weekend celebrating Days of Remembrance, memory tours, gatherings, and collective art making honoring Japanese American histories. Joining us now in our studio, we have the organizers of the Yonsei Memory Project, Nikiko Masumoto and Bryn Saito, joining us. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Joe.
Before we get into the events coming up Saturday and then also on Monday in Fresno, Nikiko, we use the word Yonsei here. What does that mean?
Yonsei, Bryn and I are both Yonsei. Yonsei is fourth generation Japanese American. And for us, it's really important that as Yonsei, we are contributing to remembering the collective histories of our communities.
And so fourth generation informs what you're doing. You are both fourth generation Japanese Americans. How does a project from your generation maybe stand out from those of other generations? Your experience certainly is different. Bryn, maybe if you could tell us from your perspective why that's significant for what your events are coming up.
Sure. So a little bit of background. There's the Issei was the first generation that came from Japan, and then the Nisei were their children, and then the Sansei were their children. So our parents are Sansei, and then we're the Yonsei. And the Nisei now are in their sort of 80s and 90s, and they were the generation to really primarily experience the Japanese American incarceration during World War II. So our grandparents' generation, and many of them are getting much older, and so we just felt such an urgency to start to really remember those histories, hear those stories, record them, and bring them alive through sort of arts and storytelling. And I think the difference of what Nikiko and I are doing as Yonsei is we're really bringing our arts practice and our practices as performers, storytellers, poets, visual artists, etc., to sort of awakening the archives of memory. So rather than just maybe recording the histories or getting them down on paper or building a monument, which is all wonderful, wonderful work that previous generations have done and many of our community have done, we're sort of asking people to engage with these histories through art and storytelling and poetry making to sort of awaken the legacies and help us carry them forward.
So you start this series of events on Saturday in the morning with something you call memory tours, Nikiko. What is a memory tour all about?
Bryn and I have envisioned and designed a couple different events this weekend, hoping to invite people to really participate in what it means to remember Japanese American history. So a memory tour will be on Saturday, both doing two tours. One is a mindfulness walking tour in collaboration with Fresno Mindfulness Walks. And then the other is a memory bus. And on each of them, we will be gathering groups of folks. It's open to anyone. The bus is full, but the mindfulness walk is open to anyone who wants to come. And together, we will be thinking about history and visiting specific places in the Central Valley that resonate with Japanese American history. And so people will get a chance to literally not only think and feel what it's like to be in those places, they'll get to exchange with each other. There will be Japanese Americans and non-Japanese Americans at all of these events. And so we're hoping people really get a chance to touch history and feel like they're a part of something much larger than themselves.
So you have that tour event taking place Saturday, and then on Monday, President's Day, Stones, Art, and Stories. Bryn, what is that event all about?
That's going to be a really special gathering, again, open to the public. We're hoping it'll be intergenerational, cross-cultural. We're going to gather at the Fresno Fairgrounds. There's a memorial there dedicated to the assembly center, the detention center, detention center that was built during World War II to detain Japanese Americans before they were actually sent to the camps like Manzanar and Topaz and Tule Lake, etc. So Fresno has a couple of those detention centers that were built for folks to they stayed there for 3 months in horse stalls and in prisons before they were actually sent to the camps for a few years. So the fairgrounds was one of those places, and they have a beautiful memorial there. So we're going to gather at the memorial and do some kind of collective art making and storytelling together, and we're hoping to make a sort of an art piece with stones, because stones have been a symbol for us of memory and carrying the weight of history and making art with stones. So everyone will have a chance to work with the stone, to place the stone in the arts, and we're hoping it'll be a very sort of powerful, possibly healing experience for all of us.
So where do you see the Yonsei Memory Project going from here? Does it have a life beyond these events? Is this something you want to see continue?
Absolutely, Joe. We've been super blessed to receive funding from the California State Library to help kick off our work together. And also community members have graciously donated to support this work. But Bryn and I, as Yonsei, we live memory in our daily lives, in the work we do both as artists and on our farm, definitely the Masumoto family farm. I feel the roots of ancestors. And so absolutely beyond this weekend, we will continue to create invitations for people to engage with memory, engage with each other, and really remember that remembering the history is an act that we can encounter in our daily lives, and it can inform the decisions we make as we move forward and what kind of country specifically we want to be. Do we want to be a welcoming country? Do we want to help heal the wounds of the past?
Nikiko, if people want more information, where can they get it?
Absolutely. Our website, yonseimemoryproject.com, and Yonsei is spelled Yonsei, yonseimemoryproject.com. We have all the information for this weekend's events, as well as some of the past events we've done, and we'll continue to post into the future.
All right. Again, the Yonsei Memory Project, Saturday the 17th, the Mindfulness Walks, And then on Monday at the Fairgrounds, Stones Art and Stories, Nakiko Masumoto and Bryn Saito. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you for having us.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or find us on Twitter. We're @KVPR and @Valley Edition. For our reporters, Laura Tsutsui, Christina Lopez, and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. On the web at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org.